Accession number 28642, Reel 5.
This is the third taped interview with Max Sheen in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 30th of the 9th, 2005, at the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, before you were telling us a little bit about how the Royal Navy was improving its methods of finding submarines and that the score was improving as time went by, how were the German submarines countering this improvement on your behalf?
Well, the German submarines were, at the time I joined Bluebell, were just getting their act together with this wolf pack technique, where they would deport themselves across the Atlantic in a line, almost within sight of each other, and hope to intercept convoys crossing the line. When one U-boat would sight a convoy, he would call BDU, which is in Germany the submarine headquarters, and report the convoy position, course and speed, and then the BDU would in turn radio all U-boats, giving them a position of the convoy and telling them, those that were in range, to concentrate on this convoy. Thereafter, from our point of view, we knew this was going on because Admiral Lee would send a signal saying, your convoy has been reported, and probably the next day we get a signal saying, there are now three U-boats shadowing your convoy, and the next day, typically, there are now nine U-boats shadowing your convoy, expect attack tonight, and we would get an attack that night. So this shows how both sides are working. The Germans were concentrating on each convoy they found, but in doing so they had to make signals, and the signals could be DF, that's direction found, because every ship, including Bluebell, had what they called HFDF, that's high frequency direction finding, or HUF, DUF as it's called, and this is a triangular assembly up on the bridge. And the telegraphists, when they received any German message, they wouldn't be able to decode it, but they would report to Admiralty the type of message and its bearing and our position. And Admiralty collated all of these reports and were able to plot most U-boats. In fact, they made it their aim to plot every U-boat every day. They didn't always do it, but by having this aim, they got very close to it. Now, this didn't require any breaking of codes. But at the same time, of course, they were working hard at breaking the codes. This is going on at Bletchley Park in England, and sometimes they would succeed, and then we'd get probably a bit more information. But we got all we needed, that is, advice as to when a convoy is likely to be attacked. Now, on our part, what would happen is that as soon as nautical twilight finished, and as soon as it became really dark, the convoy would alter course, and we hoped that the U-boats didn't know this, and we might shake them off. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But otherwise, our technique was to, at night, close in on the convoy, keep about half a mile or a mile away. Each escort vessel had its own position, and ours was usually starboard side forward of the convoy. We were just level with the front line of ships to starboard, and we'd zigzag in and out of the convoy all night. When daylight came, we would then open out to the limit of visibility, hoping to trap U-boats that were trying to overcome the convoy. But we'd normally get attacked well after sunset, when the U-boats, having shadowed the convoy all day, would be ahead of the convoy, and then they would let the convoy overtake them. Of course, all this was surmise. It wasn't until after the war that we got confirmation that this is what they were doing. But the first we would know sometimes would be when a ship would be torpedoed, and then we'd await orders, we were searching all the time with ASDIC and with radar when we got it. And sometimes an escort vessel would contact a submarine before it made an attack. Then it would attack immediately, and while it was attacking, the convoy would carry on, and the ship would eventually be left behind. Now, mostly, the senior officer would detail off the fast ships, if we had them, to take on the attack on this U-boat, and the corvette, or a corvette that found it, would resume its station. The policy was that we slow ships, our main aim was to get the ships of the convoy into harbour. The second aim was to sink U-boats, but the first aim had priority. And so when a U-boat was detected by a corvette, it usually finished up that perhaps a destroyer or two and a sloop would concentrate on that U-boat, leave the convoy, and we'd return to the convoy. And that seemed to work pretty well. Now, other aspects of defence from our point of view, because we didn't know everything the U-boats were doing, was that air cover was most important. If we could have an aircraft from Coastal Command circling the convoy all day, that would be a great advantage, because while they didn't always sink U-boats, although often they did, they would cause the U-boats to submerge, which meant they would reduce their speed from 17 knots on the surface to about 4 or 5 knots submerged, and then the convoy could leave them behind. So that was a great advantage to have a Coastal Command. I think I mentioned on the earlier interview session that we did have other aircraft available. Some were mounted on merchant ships, on catapults, and later on the escort carriers started to come into play. The first one was Empire Audacity. It became HMS Audacity, and I mentioned her before, and it was a great value. Now, as the war went on, particularly after America came in, more and more of these escort carriers became available, and they had great success. And with an escort carrier, of course, you have air cover all the time. Depending on Coastal Command, you only have it while we were within range of a land-based airfield. But we didn't. I've learned more about this since the war, when everything is published, and you can read all about what was happening in your own convoy. At the time, we only knew certain things. The development of radar was a big advantage, particularly radar in aircraft. I think 10-centimetre radar was a great British invention. We had it in Vibel, and aircraft had it too.
What was this sort of radar?
10-centimetre.
Can you describe that to us?
Well, all I know about it is that is the wavelength of the frequency on which they operated. We talk about wavelength or frequency. The product of these two was the speed of light. I can't remember what the frequency was. It didn't worry us. We had the set, and we just operated it. But when this 10-centimetre radar was fitted to aircraft, just in Coastal Command, they could fly around and watch the radar and pick up a U-boat and attack without the U-boat knowing, really, it had been detected, because this would go on at night. And particularly as they also fitted searchlights onto the aircraft, they called lay lights. And when an aircraft picked up a U-boat on radar, she would dive towards it, and the last moment switch on the light, see the U-boat, and bomb it. And this was a very effective means of attack, because the German countermeasure was to put in detection devices who would tell them when the British 10-centimetre radar had picked them up. And the whole time, these measures and countermeasures were coming into play on both sides. We didn't know too much about what the U-boat was doing in that respect. All we knew is that when Admiralty said they were about to attack, they did.
In relation to U-boats, in relation to their early success, how close a thing was it that the U-boats would win the day, as it were?
It became very close indeed. because some of our convoys, we lost ships without any kills of U-boats. Of course, if you go on like this, you're going to lose the war. We're losing ships, and Germany aren't losing U-boats. But with the various improvements in convoy procedure, we greatly overcame this, until by May 1943, by which time I'd left Bluebell. But by that time, the British and Allied countermeasures were so efficient that the score came to be one ship sunk, one U-boat sunk. And at that, it became uneconomic for the Germans to persevere. And so from that time, Dönitz ordered U-boats not to attack Allied defended convoys. So he had to pick his targets out of the way.
Well, we could talk about the result when the Americans were to join in the war following the Japanese entry. But can we talk a little bit about what the other side of your wartime life was like? What was Gibraltar like, for instance, on leave when you reached Gibraltar?
Well, Gibraltar had many advantages for us. For one thing, it's nearer the equator than Britain, so the weather there is warmer, and we enjoyed that very much. Swimming was pretty popular in Gibraltar. When we berthed on the... generally, there's a ring of berths around Gibraltar, and there's a couple of entrances. Where we were berthed was on the outer part of this, now facing Algeciras Bay. On an afternoon, making men, we would leave Bluebell, walk around to the rock, and there's a tunnel under the rock. And we walk through the tunnel and come out on the Mediterranean side and go swimming there. And that was very pleasant. And it was the first experience I had of swimming from a shingle beach. And the waves on the beach rattle these little stones, and you can feel a sort of a vibration in the back of your neck while you're swimming. But it was very pleasant indeed. When we weren't swimming, we'd go for a walk through Gibraltar shopping centre, and that was very good too, because the shops were better stocked than the shops in England, although it was mainly with British produce that they had, and that was enjoyable. A lot of people did a lot of drinking in Gibraltar. I was never a heavy drinker, and I don't think we drank ashore. We'd come back aboard the ship and probably have a beer with dinner or something like that. But one time, one of the other officers in Bluebell, Wilfred Stiff was his name, he had joined just before I did. We applied to the Spanish government for a visa to walk across the neck of Gibraltar to La Linea, which is a town nearby. It took us, we had to apply on one convoy, and when we returned after two more convoys, we picked up our visa and we walked across and had a bit of shopping in La Linea. We didn't really buy very much. I thought La Linea was not a first-rate town, but one thing that did impress us is in a window of a bookshop, there was a book by Prem, who was a fellow who sank the Royal Oak, and obviously they were sympathetic to the Nazis at that stage, so we didn't feel as though we really wanted. La Linea had a bull ring. We never went to a bullfight. Oh, I don't agree with bullfights, but that's the sort of place it was. But aboard Bluebell, I was wine caterer. Generally, the junior officer on board looked after the wines for the wardroom. And in England, we could take aboard beer and whiskey and gin. In Gibraltar, we could take on wines from Spain. And we dealt with the British wine supplier called Saccone and Speed, and they had a very convenient arrangement whereby in Liverpool we'd take aboard quite a lot of beer, as much as we could store away, and we didn't pay for it until we drank it, so it belonged to Saccone and Speed and until we consumed it. When we got to Gibraltar, there were ships based on Gibraltar, they'd run short of beer, so we used to transfer our surplus beer onto these ships until Saccone and Speed, and they would just transfer the debit to the other ships, and we would take on sherry and a little bit of port. And when we got back to England, we'd do the reverse trade. We'd send that to other ships, and it was most convenient. And also, as we didn't become liable for payment until we consumed it. In the event of our ship being sunk, all the wines and spirits aboard would not be debited to us individually. That would be Zirconia and Speed's loss. So that was a great service to the Royal Navy. Not that we drank a lot, but it did mean that it was very convenient and very economic for us. So I like Gibraltar. There's always a lot of ships there. And that's where I saw my first submarine in dry dock. And I went aboard this submarine at the invitation of a petty officer. At that time I had no intention of joining submarines, but at least I saw one.
What were your impressions?
Oh, I think I was impressed that they were very complex machines, which they are, of course, and that I didn't really want to serve in them. They didn't win me over at first sight, but I found myself in them without even trying later on, not knowing what I was in for. But all the same, it was interesting to see it, and the petty officer was really decent, and I thought I gave him a rather unkind answer when he said, "Are you thinking of joining boats?" I said, "No, not me." And I realised later on that was a stupid answer, because obviously he liked submarines, that's what he's there, and my answer indicated that I disliked them. Well, that was a very kind way to act after he'd spent an hour of his time showing me around.
We'll talk about that too. But in relation to the progress of the war up until the time that the Japanese were to enter, things weren't looking particularly hot for the Allies.
No, they weren't.
What was the situation in relation to your job and how that would...
Well, it was December 1942 that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
41.
41, yes.
Up until that time, we've got the fall of Greece and Crete and
yes.
in the middle of that year, Syrian campaign,
yes.
about the only good thing happening really yes. in many respects, Tobruk's being yes. besieged,
yes.
all of those sorts of
yes.
things.
Yes, well, that didn't affect us directly. We knew what was happening. And it wasn't reassuring, but our own bit of the war, escorting ships up and down between Liverpool and Gibraltar, was not going terribly well either. But in December 41, we'd just been fitted with radar, and that was a convoy I do remember vividly, because we were heading south. When we got opposite Portugal, there were some ships bound for Portugal, and these were dispatched from the main body of the convoy, and Bluebell and another corvette, Carnation, were detailed off to escort these ships to the coast and then to rejoin the convoy. Well, we did this, and we were coming back at night, approaching the convoy, which of course had got pretty well ahead of us, and we were coming back independently from Bluebell and Carnation, and we picked up an echo on the radar, and it turned out to be a U-boat, and we attacked that, and that was my first and only attack on a U-boat, and that was quite exciting. I think now, after many years and a lot of research, particularly when I was writing my book, I obtained the German records, and I believe we sank U-208. It's not definite, because two destroyers had also attacked a U-boat in a similar area a few days before, and between the three of us, U-208 was sunk, and as our attack was after the destroyer attack, I claim that we sank it. All this is pretty well analysed in my book, Corvette and Submarine, but that was good news. But the not so good news was that Japan was now in the war, and our two ships were sunk off from Singapore, Prince of Wales and Repulse, and that was bad. But for all that, it was the beginning of the good time for us, because with America in the war, the U-boat soon found that America was not battle-hardened as Britain was, and the convoy system had yet to been developed. Although Britain had kept America informed blow by blow of how the convoy system was going, and passed all the intelligence onto America, America had to find out for itself. And U-boats found the American shipping was much much easier targets than the ships that we were escorting. And so you find from the table in the back of my book that from that time we lost no ships. The U-boats all went across to what they called the Happy Time, to the west side of the Atlantic.
Well, we can talk about that, and I'm interested to get your opinion of the extent of U-boat activity. But in relation to sinking U-boats, did you have protocols in place to rescue survivors if any should show?
That was left to the captain. When you sink a U-boat, most times it doesn't come to the surface. It just goes down, stays down. When they do come to the surface, yes, you try to rescue survivors. But there's a risk, of course, because to rescue survivors, you've got to stop. And while you stop, you're setting target to any other U-boat. And as they hunted in packs, there are always other U-boats around. Nevertheless, we didn't ever rescue any survivors because this one attack we made on U-208, she didn't sink. She didn't come to the surface. She just disappeared. So there were no survivors. But just, we'd have picked them up. And I think the British attitude was all their seamen that lost their ship and they were destitute. They were lucky to survive. And we'd look after them as well as we could. We had limited accommodation in Bluebell. When we rescued our own survivors, that is British survivors, we housed them in the mess deck. But when you rescue enemy sailors, you got to have them under security somewhere. And about any place with a cable locker is right forward where the anchor chain is kept. Not very comfortable up there, but well, it never happened to us, so we didn't have to make up any decision on that. But I've often thought about this. It'd be pretty tricky. If you could trust an enemy crew to say, look, if you all give us your word that you'll behave yourselves and not continue the war aboard this ship because you are our guests, then we'll give you a bit more comfort. But it'd be a risk doing that, because I imagine the hardened Nazis would they wouldn't give their word, or they'd give it and break it. So if it didn't happen to us, we didn't have to do it.
Well, I do get the impression that there is this sort of code of the seaman.
Well, there is.
And how you treat someone at sea, regardless.
Yes, there is. And that's demonstrated these days between the Russians and everybody else. The Russians are not a particularly friendly crowd, but I was very thrilled recently when the British managed to rescue this small Russian submarine that was caught in cables and nets down the seabed. That was a great event. Yes, I think we would have treated them decently. But when the war's over, you're back as normal world citizens again. I think what I would have said is, look, the war's over for you, so you might as well consider yourself civilians, if so, we'll treat you with as much comfort as we can provide. That is the same comfort as we enjoy, which is not very much, but at least you'd be well fed and you kept dry. But it didn't happen.
With the entry of the Japanese into the war, December 7th, 1941, to what degree did you think of Australia?
Well, we thought of it when Japan started to make rapid progress in invading countries to the south and west. That's when we started to worry about Australia, because obviously it was going to be under threat. And nearly all Australians asked about being transferred back to Australia, but we were told to stay put and do as we were told. And I think that was probably a wise thing. So we just carried on doing what we were doing and just hoped that Australia would survive, which it did, but the threat was pretty real. It seemed real at the time. The Japanese have said they had no intention to invade Australia, but we didn't know that then.
Well, they were certainly giving it a go in relation to bombing places like Darwin and Bruce.
Yes.
Even Sydney Harbour, yes, with mini submarines.
Yes.
Were you hearing any of that news?
Yes, we heard about the attack in Sydney Harbour, but in fact it wasn't a very successful attack. They sank one Manly ferry, Catapult, and killed some people, but they didn't do any real harm. But Well, I think I accepted our orders to carry on and do our own bit of fighting, and Australia would be cared for, which I suppose it was. But you mentioned about living aboard Bluebell and what it was like. I've mentioned a couple of things, but one thing came to mind just a while ago was that one of the main, one of the mundane duties is laundry. Of course, there is no laundry. It's called dobying in the Navy. That's washing your clothes. And I did my own. And some ships, some sailors do dobying to earn a little bit of money. But I did my own. And the procedure was to get a galvanised iron bucket from the galley and put the clothes in it, soak them. There was some soap. And go down to the engine room and ask the watchkeeper if you can get a bit of steam. And he'd probably take you around to a drain, a steam drain, and he'd put a copper pipe into the bucket, turn on the tap, and there'd be a little bubbling going on, and eventually the water would boil. It's probably pretty rugged treatment for the clothes, never mind. And having got it up to boiling, take it back to the bathroom and give all the clothes a scrub, and then rinse them, and then go back to the boiler room then, to the upper part of the boiler room. There's the funnel uptakes, where we had two boilers, where the flue gases go up to the funnel. There are galleries around there, and it's always warm up there. So we'd go in there and hang our clothes on the handrails. It was fully clean, because we were oil burning, we weren't burning coal, and so you get the clothes dry that way. We didn't worry about ironing. I think we had an iron on board, but didn't worry about that too much. The main thing was to keep them clean. So that was one of the things we did in our in-between watches. Now, I can't think of too many other things that reflect on the shipboard life. We had a bathroom for the officers, and I used to shave in the bathroom, and I used to cutthroat razor. And they weren't very popular in those days. They're not popular at all now. It's only the barbers that use them. But I used to cutthroat, and the captain came to the bathroom one day while I was scraping away with this evil-looking weapon. And he said, "Look out, Shane." He said, "If you cut your throat, it won't grow again." But the ships are pretty lively, but I could use the cutthroat quite well. In fact, there's only one place I wasn't able to use it, and that was on the train from Perth to Kalgoorlie, the Kalgoorlie Rattler, as it's called, and the 3-foot-6 gauge. That was so rough. I tried to shave with the cutthroat, but it was too dangerous. But everywhere else, in Bluebell all the time, of course, when we were in submarines, we didn't shave on patrol. We shaved when we came back, so we're able to do that all right.
In relation to the experience that you would have had following the entry of the Americans into the war, how quickly was it that submarines took their attention away from you and head off?
It was very quick indeed. It was within weeks that they soon found out. Although it was good for us, we didn't lose any ships. Britain still lost a lot of ships because I've read in a book called Very Special Intelligence that with the move of U-boats over to the Western Atlantic, they were sinking American ships and they were also sinking British ships, because a lot of our ships went across there to bring cargoes back. And the intelligence people in Admiralty got very concerned about this, and so they sent a man called Wynne, who was one of their very bright people, across to America to talk them into getting their convoy technique up to date. And the American said, "Well, mind your own business. You know, this is our war." And he said, "Yeah, but you're losing British ships." And, well, eventually they did. One thing about the Americans, they are pretty proud. They like to do everything their own way. But given time, they do it very well. They develop high skill. Of course, they've got enormous industrial potential. And if you read the scores of U-boat kills late in the war, many of them went to American escort carriers. They really had great success there.
How long then was it before you came to be involved in submarines?
It was late 1942, it was September, I think, that I was still in Bluebell. We were doing our north and south run to and from Gibraltar, and every time we hit port, we were issued with a lot of publications. One series was called CAFO, it's Confidential Aerobrief Fleet Orders, and there's one, I can't remember the number and date, but I think it's in my book, during about the middle of 1942, which called for volunteers from officers and ratings for special and hazardous service. And it said that volunteers had to be below the age of 24, unmarried, good swimmers, and of strong and enduring physique.